From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. For more than 6 hours and before two congressional committees today, former special counsel Robert Mueller provided long-awaited testimony on his investigation of Russian election interference and the Trump campaign. Democrats had hoped Mueller's public testimony would provide an eye-opening education for the American people, as we hear in questioning from House Judiciary Chairman Democrat Gerald Nadler.
The report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
On the other hand, Republicans questioned the very legitimacy of the special counsel's report. Here's Devin Nunes, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee.
It's time for the curtain to close on the Russia hoax. The conspiracy theory is dead.
All day long, Robert Mueller offered terse answers likely to frustrate both Democrats and Republicans. He provided no gotcha sound bites. He was cautious, taciturn, at times halting. He stayed within the four corners of the special counsel's inquiry and refused to answer questions about ongoing investigations. But Mueller, a decorated Marine, former U.S. attorney, former deputy attorney general, and former director of the FBI, has always said his report was his testimony. Today, under oath, he went further, saying that the special counsel's report on Russian election interference is also, quote, a living message to those who come after us.
But it also is a signal, a flag to those of us who have some responsibility in this area to exercise those responsibilities swiftly and don't let this problem continue to linger as it has over so many years.
This hour on Point. Robert Mueller's testimony and what happens next. And you can join us. What's your reaction to what Robert Mueller said and what he didn't say today? Did his testimony change your opinion about Russian interference in the Trump campaign at all? And what would you like to see happen next? Join us online at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start first today in Washington with Steve Dennis. He's congressional correspondent for Bloomberg. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
So first of all, give us your analysis on whether Democrats achieved what they had hoped for in having Robert Mueller offer public testimony.
Yeah, I think that if they were looking for a jumpstart for their probes and maybe for impeachment, they didn't really get that kind of a performance from Robert Mueller. He really did not give them any new details or really any sound bites. He wouldn't even read from his report when they asked him to read some of the key damning lines. And so most of his responses were one or two words of yes or no, and basically the yes or no to, is this line in this report accurate? And he would be like, it's in the report, it's accurate. So I think as television, it was pretty terrible television. And that the whole point of having him here was not to sort of like regurgitate the report, but was to have a television picture, a movie version of the report that would get the American public sort of more familiar with the facts, because I think the frustration for the Democrats is most people still don't know all the details in this report. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was frustrating for the Democrats that he wouldn't really engage much. But, you know, towards the end, when he was asked sort of less legalistic questions and more of like the ethics of the president going out and praising WikiLeaks and their distribution of stolen emails and the ethics of not telling the FBI about all of these many, many efforts by the Russians to reach out to the Trump campaign, he did get a little bit more animated and critical of the president.
Right. So we'll hear more of that a little later in this hour. But I also want to note that Robert Mueller began both his sessions before the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees with opening remarks where he clearly said that the Russian government's effort to interfere in U.S. elections was the greatest threat or greatest challenges he's ever seen to American democracy in his career. But to your point about how this came across on the television, we definitely know that someone who watches a great deal of television and has a lot to say about it had a very strong opinion coming out of the testimony today, and that is the president himself. Here he is speaking to reporters just after Robert Mueller finished his testimony this afternoon.
The Democrats had nothing, and now they have less than nothing. And I think they're going to lose the 2020 election very big, including congressional seats, because of the path that they chose.
President Trump's response to Robert Mueller's testimony. Also just this afternoon, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi commended Democrats for holding these hearings, especially the questions that they asked of Mueller. Here she is speaking just this evening.
I do believe that what we saw today was a very strong manifestation, in fact, some would even say indictment, of this administration's cone of silence and their cover-up. This is about the oath we take to protect and defend the Constitution.
Steve Dennis, I heard you say earlier about how this may have come across on television. But what about what you hear Nancy Pelosi there say? She is the one who's been saying amongst the Democrats the most vociferously for some time that she will not begin impeachment proceedings. Is there any indication that that might change based on what she said following Mueller's testimony?
Actually, yeah, I think that may have been the most interesting thing today was when she came out with her chairman and they talked about making a case for impeachment. She basically said, look, if we decide to go that route, we want it to be the strongest possible case. We have, you know, a bunch of things that there are subpoenas outstanding that are in the courts. She referenced Watergate, that broke when they got the tapes. They're still trying to get a lot of evidence, and they have a lot of subpoenas out for people to come testify. And she talked about needing to educate the American people and today being a part of that. But, you know, those chairmen were talking about a responsibility to act. They talked about history. They talked about, you know, Elijah Cummings was talking about people are going to be looking at this a couple hundred years from now. And the other thing that happened in this hearing is pretty much every House Judiciary Democrat said that the president would have been, and the Speaker, that the president would have been indicted but for this Department of Justice rule saying that you can't indict sitting presidents. And they also said the president can't be above the law. Well, the only remedy available to them really is impeachment. Anything else is a slap on the wrist. And she also said that she would not not impeach, given the fact that the Senate is in Republican hands and has no interest in convicting him. She made it clear that if they have a case for impeachment, they have to go ahead and do it and basically do their duty. And so she said it wouldn't be about politics. It would be basically about patriotism and duty. Now, that sort of laid a predicate for going ahead, even if today is not a great television day. You can imagine later this fall when they start getting through these court fights, if they win some of these court fights and get some more evidence and get some of these witnesses in front of television cameras, that they could have an impeachment this fall. It's a very big decision for them, and it's not clear which way they're going to go.
Well, Steve Dennis, congressional correspondent for Bloomberg, who has been covering the Mueller investigation and was writing a breaking news blog about this all day long today. Steve, thank you so very much.
Thanks for calling me.
It's been a long day. Thanks so much, Steve. Okay, so those are some of the immediate political implications from Robert Mueller's testimony today. Let's spend the rest of this hour really digging into what he told members of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. So first of all, here's a moment from Mueller's testimony before the Intelligence Committee, where you will hear Democrat and Chairman Adam Schiff questioning Mueller on the president's frequent characterizations of the special counsel's investigation as, quote, a witch hunt.
When Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
Well, on the other hand, Devin Nunes, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, questioned the very legitimacy of the special counsel's investigation, and here's part of his opening statement.
And now that Mr. Mueller is here, they are claiming that the collusion has actually been in his report all along, hidden in plain sight. And they're right. There is collusion in plain sight. Collusion between Russia and the Democratic Party. The Democrats colluded with Russian sources to develop the Steele dossier. And Russian lawyer Natalia Veselskaya colluded with the dossier's key architect, Fusion GPS head Glenn Simpson.
ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes there. Well, joining us now is Victoria Nurse. She's with us from Washington. She is a Georgetown University Law Center professor, chief counsel to the Vice President of the United States between 2015 to 2016. Victoria Nurse, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Josh Blackman also joins us. He's with us from Houston, Texas. He's associate professor at South Texas College of Law and contributor to Lawfare, the national security blog from the Lawfare Institution. Josh Blackman, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Victoria, let me just begin with you. What is your big takeaway from Mueller's testimony today?
My takeaway is pretty simple. Election security. The morning was spent with a lot of going back and forth in this 5-minute rounds and was very sort of difficult to follow. But if you looked at the afternoon, you would hear a very cogent case made for the need for election security, to the point where the witness said that even as he spoke, the Russians were in fact attempting to infect our electoral system. And he appealed to all Americans, Republicans and Democrats, to join together to fight this. So I see the entire issue shifting away from the criminal law frame. I've taught criminal law for 10 years. It's very hard in this kind of situation with a president and the definitions of what's a corrupt motive to actually come to conclusions here. Mm. But when we're talking about something more like loyalty, I think it's easier for the American people to see that's the real question.
Well, Victoria Nurse, stand by here for a second. Josh Blackman, we just have to take a really quick break. And when we come back, I'll get your big take on what we learned from Robert Mueller's testimony today. And that's what we are indeed talking about, the 6 hours of testimony from the special counsel before two House committees today. Did you watch it? What did you learn? Did it change your opinion or your view on what should happen next regarding Russian interference in American elections? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about Robert Mueller's 6 hours of congressional testimony today and what we learned and what we didn't learn from the special counsel's, former special counsel's, public answering of questions from members of the House. I'm joined today by Victoria Nurse. She's professor at Georgetown University Law Center. And Josh Blackman is also with us. He's an associate professor at South Texas College of Law. And Josh, before the break, you heard Victoria talk about the fact that her big takeaway is one of turning attention towards election security. And in fact, as she noted, Robert Mueller, before the House Intelligence Committee at the end, multiple times said, they, being the Russians, are doing it, interfering with our elections as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign. He talked about how he believes that section of the special counsel's report was underplayed, and he also answered about his concerns regarding foreign adversaries. He said, "I hope this is not the new normal, but I fear it is." So, what's your response to that?
Well, I think the key word for today was expectations, right? What did people expect? 2 decades ago, Ken Starr testified before Congress after a lengthy investigation of President Clinton. His riveting testimony accused the sitting president of breaking the law. Ken Starr urged the remedy was impeachment. Today, Mueller did quite the opposite. His bland testimony repeatedly stopped short of accusing President Trump of breaking the law. And he refused to comment on what actions Congress should take, which is impeachment. So the only real takeaway was not from Volume 2 of the report. That's what concerned obstruction. The main takeaway was Volume 1 of the report, which was the efforts of foreign countries to intervene in our elections. And that does not fit the political moment we're in right now. People wanted red meat. They wanted sound bites. They wanted things to take down the president. And instead, we got a sober warning of how our country's under threat. I think this is a bipartisan issue that everyone should take quite seriously.
Well, so Victoria, to Josh's point here, we have a moment from the Judiciary Committee hearing where Democratic Congresswoman Veronica Escobar of Texas quoted from the special counsel's report, where it was written that the special counsel's office did not want to, quote, potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. So she asked Mueller to elaborate.
What are those constitutional processes?
I think I heard you mention at least one.
Impeachment, correct?
I'm not going to comment.
Okay. That is one of the constitutional processes listed in the report in the footnote in Volume 2.
So, Victoria, is this Robert Mueller being being the prosecutor that he is and staying within the bounds of the report, staying within the strictures put on him just yesterday by the Department of Justice? Or is it Robert Mueller not willing to put forth any kind of opinion on what he thinks regarding about possible impeachment?
Well, the short answer is he's a straight-up guy. He is following the rules laid down by the Justice Department. And that's what you have to remember. This is why he's not Ken Starr. Ken Starr was operating under a very different statute known as the Independent Counsel Statute. I had my problems with that statute, by the way. But these are regulations. They're created by the department. He is was an employee of the department. And as a prosecutor, he has to follow the department's rules, which means you can't comment on a lot of cases. And my sense was that in many of the instances where he appeared halting, you have to put yourself in a position of someone who knows an enormous amount of classified information relating to the highest office in the country. And you don't want to slip up. So it was difficult to watch, I think, in part because of that. But I think we have to understand, and this is where I don't think it's about, you know, red meat and zingers so much as thinking about the future, which is, should we really have special counsels under these regulations? One of my colleagues wrote the regulations. I think that he did a great job. But I'm not so sure that the president can investigate himself. I mean, it's an old saying in the separation of powers field, no person should be a judge in their own cause. And what's happened to the special counsel is that they're pretty much been hemmed in by these regulations and by this attorney general who's hostile to the investigation. And Mueller either had two courses. He could have gone after Barr or he could have tried to toe the line. And one of the risks of going after Barr, even if he's a private citizen and not reading the report, is that he'll be in a television commercial for someone. So that's why he had other people read the report. That's right. Why he had other people say the word impeachment. Mm.
Well, so Josh Blackman, respond to that, because we did hear Republicans in both the Judiciary and Intelligence Committee meetings today basically go after Robert Mueller for not being explicitly clear in the special counsel's report about impeachment, right? I mean, Ken Starr was repeatedly invoked, but of course, as Victoria was pointing out, under the Independent Counsel Act, Starr had the statutory obligation to do so, whereas that's not in the special counsel's regulations. So what did you make of Republicans trying to sort of pin that on Mueller?
Victoria is absolutely correct. Ken Starr had a specific charter to recommend impeachment to Congress. Robert Mueller, in contrast, was to provide a confidential report to the attorney general. It's confidential. It may never have seen the light of day. Now, we know that Barr released it with some redactions, but it was never supposed to be for Congress to see. And in fact, Mueller was an executive branch employee. So I think Mueller had to be very careful not to step outside the boundaries of what he was hired and appointed to do. And I think, moreover, the bigger question, which I'm sure we'll discuss, is why did he approach the obstruction question the way he did? If we all know the president can't be charged and can't be indicted under department policy, then why did he develop this lengthy report laying out allegations that could not lead to an indictment? Now, maybe he did it for after the president left office. He was somewhat cagey on that point. But there were several issues that Mueller sort of tiptoed around that I think leave everyone a little bit unsatisfied.
Mm. Well, so to that point, let's listen briefly to when Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu of California pressed Robert Mueller on why he didn't offer an opinion or an indictment of President Trump.
To recap what we've heard, we have heard today that the president ordered former White House counsel Don McGahn to fire you. The president ordered Don McGahn to then cover that up and create a false paper trail. And now we've heard the president ordered Corey Lewandowski to tell Jeff Sessions to limit your investigation so that you stop investigating the president. I believe a reasonable person looking at these facts could conclude that all three elements of the crime of obstruction of justice have been met. And I'd like to ask you, the reason, again, that you did not indict Donald Trump is because of OLC opinion stating that you cannot indict a sitting president, correct?
That is correct.
That's Robert Mueller responding to a question from Congressman Ted Lieu. And Ted Lieu referenced the OLC, which is the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice, and its longstanding policy of not indicting sitting presidents. Now, a lot of people thought that at that moment, Robert Mueller had actually made some news. That was in the Judiciary Committee hearing. Later in the afternoon, though, before the House Intelligence Committee, in his opening statement, Mueller offered a clarification.
I want to go back to one thing that was said this morning by Mr. Lieu, who said, and I quote, "You didn't charge the president because of the OLC opinion." That is not the correct way to say it. As we say in the report, and as I said at the opening, we did not reach a determination as to whether the president committed a crime.
Now, Victoria Nurse, help us understand this here, because a lot of people reacted immediately to the Lieu questioning and said, aha, here's Robert Mueller saying he would have indicted the president had it not been for DOJ policy. Mueller comes back and offers a clarification. Explain the nature of this clarification to us.
Well, as I understand it, many people have the theory that, in fact, the reason you can't indict a sitting president is because the Constitution provides a sole remedy, and that remedy lies in Congress's impeachment power. So if you do take that view, and many people believe that Mueller takes that view, it is not for him to determine whether there is a crime or there is not a crime, because the term high crimes and misdemeanors is a term of art. We have had a series of, you know, a few attempts at attempting to impeach folks by the House of Representatives, none successful. But he was deferring to them, essentially, under this constitutional theory, in my view. That is the department's theory, as I understand it.
And Josh Blackman, how would you explain it?
It's a little bit complicated, but let me walk you through it. Had Robert Mueller written the following report, let's say he said this: I have determined that the president committed obstruction of justice, and I would recommend an indictment, but I can't because of the DOJ policy, right? He could have written that. But had he written that, I'm almost positive the attorney general said, no, you cannot put that forward. This is inconsistent with policy. Mm-hmm. I think Mueller wanted to avoid that. So he sort of took this half measure. Instead, he said, we're not going to say he's innocent. We're not going to say he's going to be charged. We're going to just leave it out there to let everyone else connect the dots. And I think that was the sort of half-measure approach he took. To avoid running into the attorney general's buzzsaw, Mueller simply took this half-measure and basically told everyone he's guilty, but didn't actually say it and kept tiptoeing around it. And this is the one part of the report that still irks me. And I would have rather Mueller just omitted the entirety of Volume 2, or at least most of Volume 2, which was on obstruction. He could have just said, Russia interference, we've reached our conclusions, and because the president cannot be indicted, we're not going to pursue these charges further. I think that would have been a better approach, but we now have this report for posterity, and maybe he wants potential indictments after President Trump leaves office. It's also a possibility.
Well, let's get a couple calls in here. Let's go to Barry, who's calling from Cabot, Vermont. Barry, you're on the air.
Well, I have two things. One, the objection by many that there's no such thing legally as exoneration. The word exonerate is plain English, and it needn't be heard as a legal statement. And then the second thing that has bothered me is that pundits all day have been saying, we've learned nothing from this. Those are the pundits who have read the Mueller report. There are millions of people in the audience who haven't read the Mueller report, and they're hearing more about it. They heard more about it today than they would have and learned more about it than they would have from their local papers and their local TV stations.
Mm. Barry, thank you for your call. So, Victoria Nurse, would you agree with Barry that even in his taciturn answers, that Robert Mueller offered some kind of education to the American public?
Yes. I mean, I think that the House was very disciplined. They divided up the counts. They walked through the evidence. They were succinct and very organized. Sometimes it seemed like there was a split hearing because the other side said, well, the investigation is illegitimate. But I think the American people did learn a lot about the basic issues in both volumes of the report. And I think that if they had watched through the entire hearing, they should learn more about what was really at stake with respect to election interference.
Hmm. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Choctaw, Oklahoma. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple comments about, you know, President Trump. It's almost like he doesn't hear what is going on. He's still telling us that, you know, he didn't commit. There wasn't anything. He didn't do anything wrong. My second, and it aggravates me. My second thing is that this is a serious thing. The Russians taking over. After a while, we're not going to be able to get who we want as president, which most people didn't get who they wanted this time. And it's only going to be who Russia wants, or maybe other countries are going to go start doing what Russia does. This is scary stuff. That's my comment.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for your call. So, Josh Blackman, you heard Mary there once again bringing us back to the issue of Robert Mueller warning about the ongoing interference that he says is happening from the Russian government here. I mean, did the Democrats perhaps did today's testimony offer them a springboard upon which to push for more legislation to protect the American election process, or do you think they missed an opportunity to further highlight it during Mueller's testimony today?
You know, I would have preferred two sets of hearings, right? There were two volumes of the report. Let's have two hearings. The first hearing could focus solely on volume one and Russian interference. And I think at that point, the Republicans would have had a harder time making these sorts of political jabs. And we could have had actually a consensus. But by blending together the Russian interference with the obstruction analysis, it opened up to this sort of this political circus, which we were watching all day unfold before us. So I do fear, and I think the caller is well stated, that the important message might not be carried through. And I don't know that any legislation will come out of this. I think we'll see impeachment referrals and things of that nature. But we are now, you know, less than a year and a half to the next presidential election. I'm not sure that the key aspects of Volume 1, the living history that Mueller said, will speak to us.
Mm. Well, Victoria, Robert Mueller also today, when he was asked, you know, what could be done, how could we strengthen our elections or our election security, he talked about information sharing on elections between intelligence agencies. And if I remember correctly, there is bipartisan legislation about exactly this that Senate Majority Mitch McConnell is currently blocking from reaching the Senate floor. Is that right?
That's what I heard today, yeah, too, from former Senator Claire McCaskill, who – and I do know that the House has passed some election security bill. I think there'll be more public support for that. I don't understand which bills that Mitch McConnell decides to bring to the floor and which he doesn't. But I think there'll be more pressure. You'll see it from the candidates who are running for the Democratic nomination. They've been listening today as well. I also think that, you know, one of the problems here is that there were not simultaneous hearings. You know, when I was a baby lawyer and I worked on Iran-Contra, the Senate and the House had simultaneous hearings along with the president's own investigation, right? Mm-hmm. So he had the Tower report, and then – so he put out his own report, and then the House and Senate put out their own report, and they had witnesses. And, you know, it didn't come out the way that some Democrats wanted, but at least everybody did their due diligence in that way. And I think the public understood, and they actually sort of pushed back on the Democratic narrative at that time. Here, you know, what's odd is that you know, that tradition has gone by the wayside, and everybody has attempted to focus on criminalizing. That criminal frame is actually very difficult and fraught. It's fraught both when it's applied to President Clinton and applied to President Trump. It's not the appropriate frame for this. It wasn't the appropriate frame for that, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to go back to thinking about what role Congress has in investigating these kinds of questions about loyalty.
Well, we are talking this hour about what Robert Mueller said and what he didn't say before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees today over the course of 6 hours of public testimony. We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what we did learn and didn't learn from Robert Mueller's 6 hours of public testimony today before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. I'm joined today by Victoria Nurse. She's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and was chief counsel to the vice president between 2015 to 2016. Josh Blackman also joins us. He's an associate professor at South Texas College of Law, contributor to Lawfare, the national security blog, and author of Unprecedented, The Constitutional Challenge to Obama. And let's listen to a moment from Robert Mueller's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee. That was the first committee he faced this morning. Here's Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado asking the former special counsel about the question of obstruction of justice.
Could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
So, Josh Blackman, this was one of those moments where I think perhaps people were surprised by both Buck's questioning and maybe even Mueller's answers. What did you make of that moment?
Well, there are two questions, right? Can you charge the sitting president with a crime? And it's long been DOJ policy that you cannot. But the DOJ has never taken a position on whether a former president can be charged, and I don't see any reason why not. The most famous historical example of this is President Gerry Ford issued a pardon to former President Nixon. And he did this to try to avoid the sort of acrimony and hostility that could result from actually bringing Richard Nixon into federal court, as that might have happened. And that was a very unpopular thing that Ford did. So in theory, at least, if President Trump is a one-term president and he leaves office, he could, in theory, be charged with some acts of obstruction. I think there are reasons why some of the charges may not go forward, but he could be charged by the next attorney general. If President Trump is reelected, if my math is right, the statute of limitations might run, that this is a period which says you cannot charge someone after more than a certain number of years. If Trump serves a full 8 years, certain conduct from 2016 and 17 may be beyond the scope. So by virtue of winning re-election, the president may actually run out the clock on any possible future indictments, although who knows what happens next. There's some theories that maybe you could put the statute of limitations on hold. But I don't think that was that controversial. Once President Trump's out of office, he doesn't have that barrier where the attorney general works for him, and the separation of power suggests that you can't have someone working for you try with a crime.
Right. I mean, so Victoria, I would agree with Josh that presuming the statute of limitations isn't run out, that as a private citizen, I don't know of any practice that would say he would not – a president would not be subject or to possible indictment. So why is it that that Republican Congressman Ken Buck would have even asked those questions?
Well, I think he wanted to get some things on the record in terms of whether, in fact, people were seeking to or Democrats had some interest in potentially indicting the president. And it may have not been what he had assumed. You know, I think getting this issue out is important at this point for everyone because, in fact, this may affect whether people want to do a pre-impeachment or impeachment hearing in the House, which attempts to document the conduct so that, in fact, because it could, in fact, evade review. It's also, as Professor Blackman indicated, the obstruction of justice and corrupt motive are actually very difficult to prove. So particularly with a president who has other motives and other powers. So, you know, the idea that there's actually going to be such a prosecution, I think, remains to be seen. And that might have been where Buck was headed. Mm-hmm. But it also plays into the hands of those who say, well, yeah, we've got to go to impeachment because, in fact, there's no other remedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to Leo, who's calling from Windsor, Connecticut. Leo, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm an independent and also an immigrant. Came here to this country about 40 years ago. A couple things. I consider this whole thing a tremendous waste of time, number one. Secondly, I did learn something, and it came more from the Republican side, where it was interesting who got prosecuted and who didn't in the process, and I couldn't follow all the names. My third point is, boy, this country has, it's almost a policy to interfere in other countries' elections, from South America to the Middle East to wherever. We're always interfering, and there's tremendous hypocrisy to this whole idea here. We should just protect our system and just assume that some other government is going to try to have some kind of angle. And also, I really applaud WikiLeaks. I think people should know what's going on. You should, maybe you shouldn't write things that you can't share.
Right.
So, Leo,
thank you for your call. And Joseph Blackman, let me explore Leo's middle point there, because many Republican members on these committees did indeed sort of drill down into the question of Joseph Mifsud, the London-based professor, right, who had originally told George Papadopoulos that the Russian government may have had, quote, dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of those emails. And the Republican members of these committees, Jim Jordan, for example, asked Robert Mueller that, quote, this is what Jordan said, you can charge all kinds of people who are around the president with false statements, but the guy who launches everything, the guy who puts the whole story into motion, you can't charge him. I think that's amazing. That's what Congressman Jordan said. So, Josh Blackman, your analysis of why Republicans did spend quite a bit of time on that issue.
There's a lot of mystique in how Robert Mueller got his job. I mean, why was he appointed? And I think we have to go back to the beginning of the campaign. There was a counterintelligence investigation fairly early on to see whether President Trump had some sort of, I'll use the word collusion, they don't like that word, but whether it was candidate Trump had collusion with the Russian government. And that spawned a lot of different elements, where perhaps President Trump, through several intermediaries, had contacts with people who had contacts with the WikiLeaks, which had contacts with the Russians, you know, this sort of chain of conspiracies. And ultimately, the special counsel found that they couldn't go forward with any sort of allegations. Part of the reason why is WikiLeaks, right? What's the difference between WikiLeaks and a newspaper or a radio station? I think I can draw some distinctions, but there's a very dangerous precedent going after people who release information. Think of the Pentagon Papers case for the New York Times. I think that in part is why Mueller couldn't push this further. He was nervous that charging people with accepting information from WikiLeaks, et cetera, could set a precedent of going after newspapers who get reports from anonymous sources. So this was not going to be a slam dunk case, even if they had all the facts, right? This is politics. Politics is dirty. People get opposition research from lots of sources. We should not be getting opposition research from foreign governments. I think that's a very good thing you should not do. Don't get that sort of information. But the fact that you're getting this information does have free speech implications beyond Trump.
Well, so Victoria, I'm going to switch gears here for a little bit, because I also want to explore another avenue of criticism that we heard from many members, Republican members of the two committees today. And these were criticisms of how Robert Mueller operated as special counsel during the course of the two-year investigation. So first of all, here's Congressman John Ratcliffe, Republican from Texas, during the House Judiciary hearing, accusing Mueller of breaking Justice Department regulations.
You managed to violate every principle and the most sacred of traditions about prosecutors not offering extra prosecutorial analysis about potential crimes that aren't charged. So Americans need to know this as they listen to the Democrats and socialists on the other side of the aisle, as they do dramatic readings from this report, that volume 2 of this report was not authorized.
That's Congressman John Ratcliffe at the Judiciary hearing today, going right after Robert Mueller's own behavior, allegedly. Well, Mueller, also Republicans really pushed hard on what they believe or they saw as alleged bias amongst the special counsel's own team. And that actually provoked, I think, some of Mueller's strongest responses. For example, listen to how Robert Mueller responds to accusations from North Dakota Republican Representative Kelly Armstrong.
Can I speak for a second to the hiring practices?
Sure.
We strove to hire those individuals that could do the job. I've been in this business for almost 25 years. And in those 25 years, I have not had occasion once to ask somebody about their political affiliation. It is not done. What I care about is the capability of the individual to do the job and do the job quickly and seriously and with integrity.
It's Robert Mueller before the Judiciary Committee. Victoria Nurse, I wanted to play those two points because there was something that linked some of the Republican criticism of Mueller today. And that was the assertion that they believe it inherent political bias amongst members of the special counsel's team, and that therefore there was no possible way the Office of the Special Counsel could have come up with a politically unbiased investigation. And you heard Robert Mueller there saying in 25 years he's never once asked about political affiliation. That's just not what is done. I mean, is the GOP here moving towards just creating a presumption that we cannot have unbiased investigations coming out of the Department of Justice?
That, to me, is the second scary element of this, that there are no facts, that everything is just fake news. I do think that when you don't have a good defense, what you do is you attack the investigator. I mean, there are plenty of witnesses before Congress who have attacked Congress, and they've done it very successfully. So you can think of Ollie North, others. That's what they're doing. And the truth is we can't know. And here's why we can't know. As Bill Barr said, and the reason he can't give us the unredacted report is there is a lot of highly secure information in that report. You can tell if you know how this, you know, by the color coding. And when you release highly secure information, people can die. That's the problem with WikiLeaks. It's not that it's a newspaper. It's that when they release things, our agents die. So when you release national security information, you're in trouble. So I think that this defense, you know, is sort of standard. I mean, you attack the committee if you don't think you're going to win on the merits. And one of the things that keeps bothering me about the whole obstruction thing is, yes, they were right to say, look, why did you put the obstruction material in this report if you couldn't indict him? You know, and Professor Blackman mentioned that earlier. That is troubling. Why did you do that? And that's what the first comment was about. On the other hand, if he didn't do that, we would still have the same question because a lot of this is in plain sight. It's in plain sight when the president says things like, I'm going to, fire people, or I want the investigation. It's a hoax, or it's all fake. So it's a very difficult thing. Now, will we never know? Will we ever know? Maybe somebody will write a book and tell us all about what's going on. But we're not going to know immediately before the next election. And that's why I think we should stop focusing on perhaps whether the committee was biased or whether there should have been a criminal indictment and focus more on what we can do and what the American public needs to get their mind around, which is that whoever wins, this is going to cast a shadow and a scary shadow over whether they're a legitimate president in the next election unless we don't get our act together.
Well, Josh Blackman, I hear Victoria saying when she says we ought to stop focusing potential bias here. But on the other hand, the GOP does seem to be Republican members of these committees today seem to be attacking the idea that investigators can rise above party and serve the rule of law in legal investigations. Does that trouble you?
I think an inherent criticism of all special counsels is that they're appointed for one job and one job alone, to investigate a specific cause. And generally, that will be the cause of the incumbent administration. Nearly three decades ago, we had a Supreme Court decision called Morrison v. Olson. This was during the Reagan administration. And the Supreme Court was asked, is this independent counsel constitutional? And the court ruled 7-1 that it was fine, that you could have this. And the lone dissent was from Justice Scalia, who ruled that the entire notion of having a prosecutor who was basically investigating the executive branch, unencumbered by the executive branch, was contrary to the separation of powers. He described this as a very bad thing. Mm. And we kind of saw that during the Ken Starr era, where this independent counsel started with land transactions in Arkansas and moved on to sexual allegations involving Monica Lewinsky. And it sort of just was unbounded. And it was a disaster. Okay, yeah. So we replaced independent counsel with a sort of more narrow, a special counsel like Robert Mueller. And then his handcuffs, right? Mm. His hands were tied and he wasn't able to do what everyone wanted him to do.
Right.
So ultimately, the job falls to Congress. If Congress wants to impeach, they can. If they don't, they won't. But let's be honest here. They didn't need a 2-year investigation to impeach the president. Congress could have filed an article of impeachment the day after James Comey was fired. Right? They didn't need this detailed 500-page report to go forward with this. They could have began an investigation within Congress and not have to rely on the executive branch. So we have this general shirking where Congress wants to take the benefits of the report, but they don't want to do the hard work. And if they don't want to do the hard work, then this matter falls to the electorate. We have an election coming up in a few, about 18 months, and we'll decide what happens then. But this is for Congress. This was never for Robert Mueller to be the Cape Crusader, coming with the man of steel mm-hmm. and save everyone. That was not going to happen.
Well, we've just got a minute left here to go. And my final question is based on a comment that we got from Matthew Teague on our website about the court of public opinion here, because Matthew says the majority of people will, quote, learn from Mueller what they had already pre-decided they would learn from him. It's laying bare the insanity of each group having their own separate set of facts that they will believe regardless of any evidence to the contrary. Victoria, I've just got a couple of seconds left. I'm wondering what your response is to that this today, as momentous as it might have been, may not have actually moved the needle in the public mind.
Well, I think it's like elections. There are people who have pre-decided the election, but there's always people who are still wavering until the last minute and people who just tuned in. So I think for a certain segment of people, it will have an effect, and they'll learn something about what's going on in our electoral system.
Well, Victoria Nurse, professor at Georgetown University Law Center, chief counsel to the vice president. She served in that position between 2015 to 2016, and a former appellate lawyer in the Justice Department and special counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Victoria Nurse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Josh Blackman, associate professor at South Texas College of Law, contributor to Lawfare, the national security blog, and author of Unprecedented, the Constitutional Challenge to Obamacare. Thank you so much for joining us tonight as well.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.